that will not be forthcoming to the police. They will not go to the police station and say, I have information, I want to give a statement. It's information that comes to the family. And so that role of connecting with the family to see what they know, to interview them, to be able to explore anything that the family has heard, that is why the investigation should have always started with the family and started with the community.
Again, Anna Betty Ashnapaniskum speaks for the chiefs of Anishinaabe Aski Nation.
They didn't do a proper investigation. And then through the reinvestigations, there wasn't any chance at all in terms of finding someone responsible. There was no indication that would happen. The reinvestigation just proved what we already knew, that they didn't do the job. They did not do a proper investigation. They did not investigate your child's death properly. That's what it says. Now what? Nothing. There's nothing that can be done. No one's going to be held accountable.
So I just want to break this down for you. Number one, there was a review of the police and death investigations. Number two, then a reinvestigation of deaths that has already been investigated. Number three, a review of more deaths and even more cases to be investigated. Number four, finally, a review of the investigations to tell you how the process has gone wrong yet again, over and over and over again. Families have been doing this for years. No one in the system was ever going to be held responsible. The disconnect between what the reinvestigations were supposed to do and what families wanted them to do or believed they were going to do were different things.
And the people who are doing the reinvestigations were taking a second look at cases their own offices had worked on.
This report still hasn't come out yet. Nevertheless, the Ontario Provincial Police have already started taking a second look at 14 additional cases.
And there's another 25 cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls that have been flagged as needing reinvestigation too.
Thunder Bay is going to have to keep going through this, even though all the evidence shows us this system isn't capable of getting justice or peace for the families of those who have passed under mysterious circumstances.
At least not yet. And meanwhile, more investigations are coming, more reports, more promises to do better. That's where we're going from here. Anna Betty Ashnapaniskum says she's in this for as long as it takes.
We're not going to quit until all of them are investigated. And also, I think that for any unfortunate death that may happen here. I know right now they know they're in the spotlight, right? So they're being very careful, and they better be damn careful.
That's your Canada Land. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. We're on Twitter at Canada Land, and our website is canadaland.com. This episode was reported by Ryan McMahon, John Thompson, and Charisse Suturin. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Additional production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Our managing editor is Annette Ejiofor. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Jan Wong, journalist, author, teacher, flautist.
Hi, Jesse. Happy to be here.
Today on the show, Jan, Canada's Jeffrey Epstein and Canada's other Jeffrey Epstein. And the Ontario high school teacher under fire for teaching about socialist economics in his economics class. Huh. Welcome back to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news. Quick note before we begin that in this first segment, we will be discussing the sexual exploitation and assault of minors.
We have breaking news to bring you this hour. Former fashion mogul Peter Nygaard,
after 5 days of deliberation,
guilty of 4 counts of sexual assault.
For years, allegations of sexual assault have swirled around Peter Nygaard.
Many of these charges go back decades.
Jan, if Jeffrey Epstein had been a Canadian, like, I'm not going to say nobody would have known about him. I'm saying we would have lost interest in a week. Like, we just, what's the opposite of a media circus? How could we, like, I understand there's things going on all over the world, but, like, we have news in Canada that's worth paying attention to. Peter Nygaard, first of all, have you seen photos of this guy after his conviction?
Yeah, I have. He looks sort of like a ghost now. He's so frail and old. He looks like a wraith. I think the opposite of a media circus is a media snooze.
This is not a snooze. He looks like a Disney villain.
Yeah. No, but I mean, the media has been asleep at the switch with the Nygaard trial.
He was just found guilty on 4 counts of sexual assault. He was acquitted on a 5th count, and he'd also been charged with forcible confinement. I mean, I won't go through the entire Peter Nygaard story. We've talked about it before, and there's like documentaries and stuff out there. I'm not saying that this wasn't covered, but this was the end, the culmination of this story of a guy who has been sexually assaulting women since the 60s.
Yes.
And similar to Epstein, had a whole network of cronies and enforcers and intimidators, and all of the questions that come with these of, like, how soon did the authorities know, and why, you know, they had pressed charges decades ago. Why did that not go anywhere? How was he given the Queen's Jubilee? Like, how is this guy? Like, all of this shit happened over the course of decades. It's wild.
So I went into his lair.
What do you mean?
He was headquartered in Winnipeg, but his big office was in Toronto, and it happened to be 2 blocks from the Globe and Mail. And I started this column called Lunch With, and I thought, who do I really want to take to lunch? And I thought, Peter Nygaard. So he was, I think, my first lunch.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So
I'm just learning this right now. I mean, everyone remembers your Lunch With Jan column, but I did not know that you had lunch with Peter Nygaard.
Yeah, he was like the first one, or maybe it was Miss Canada Newfoundland who punched out her rival in a bar. I can't remember. But Nygaard's column took me 6 months to get into the paper. It was lawyered and lawyered and lawyered. So I go over, and I'm just beginning to figure out how to interview people for the lunch column, and he has no idea. You know, he's done many interviews, always sycophantic, always everybody's talking about how successful he is, and I walk in and I'm smiling, and he gives me the yeah, I know.
I looked like you. I wish I could walk into an interview and
we
just look alike,
Jesse.
Lovely and pleasant like you.
People would not be able to tell us apart. What are you talking about?
You look like you come in peace. And then, oh my God, he did not know what he was getting himself into.
So he gave me a big tour of the lair. Yeah. Now, I did not see the bedroom, full disclosure. He did not take me into that bedroom with the keypad lock. But he did show me the plexiglass floor with a goldfish pond in it. He wanted me to stand over it, and he touched me. He was, like, positioning me, you know, holding onto my shoulders. You know, it was kind of very creepy, but I was just smiling, and I walked up the stairs behind him, and I wanted to know if he wore elevator lifts in his boots, and he does. But my editor said, you can't just say that you saw them. You have to get another source. So I got another source, you know, editors. So I got another source. The reason it took me 6 months and the reason I wanted to interview Nygaard is I had been tipped off by people in Winnipeg that there were sexual assault allegations against him. And there was a rape charge against him way back then. This is 26 years ago in 1997. And so I followed that rape case, and it turned out that the woman left town. She was given money and she got out of town.
Uh-huh.
So I said, I need the paper. Turns out that his lawyer had taken the paper, and you can request that it be like destroyed after a year. And he requested it. Very unusual, but the police, the Crown destroyed it. Then I went after the human rights complaints. Three women accused him of sexual misconduct, and they went to the human rights. Well, they had to sign non-disclosure agreements.
Uh-huh.
So I couldn't get them to talk to me, of course. Otherwise, they would violate. So my newspaper, The Globe, really fought me on that. You know, they said, you don't have it, you don't have it, you don't have it.
They fought you after the interview?
Yes, because I wrote it all, and they said, you can't say this. You don't have the paper on the sexual assault.
But did you ask him about this over lunch?
Yes, I did, and that's when he threw me out.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and I'm so stupid. I was taping it. I'm so stupid. He threw me out, and, you know, I was gathering up my papers and my notebooks, and I turned off my tape recorder. Like, journalism 101, never turn your tape recorder. I was so the editor said, and the lawyer said, well, what do you have? And I said, well, I have all my notes, because I went right back and I wrote it all down. And in a court of law, a reporter's notes are good enough.
That's right. You don't have to have audio or
video. Yeah, you don't have to have audio.
You were there. You as an eyewitness. Like, can you write about being thrown out was the question.
Because I wanted to write about, I asked him about the sexual assault and he threw me out, right? That's as good as writing about it.
Yes.
And they wouldn't let me. And I just, even if I had taped it, they probably wouldn't let me. Because before, I told you that his headquarters was two blocks from the Globe office. Before I got back to my office, there was a letter in the fax machine. Those were the fax days. In the fax machine threatening me with being sued. I hadn't written a word. I had just gone over for sandwiches.
So they did not forbid you from writing the simple fact that you know, it's a series of events. You asked him about, like, charges on the record, and he threw you out. You saw this happened. You're a reporter like any other Globe Mail. They didn't forbid you from writing about that because you didn't have audio tape. They forbid you because they're cowards.
Yeah, they were cowards. They were scared. And, you know, and the NDAs didn't help. It was really tough. And that's why, you know, I am helping people who are fighting NDAs, because for journalism, we don't want whistleblowers. We don't want victims to be silenced. It's so important, because what happened is he went on for another quarter century of molesting and raping his way across Montreal, Winnipeg, Toronto, New York, and wherever he has his island retreat. I think it's the Bahamas.
But you tried to stop him. In your capacity as a journalist, you tried to expose him and you fought to the
public.
I did not know any of this. This is so interesting, Jan, and good for you. Oh, my God.
Yeah, but I failed.
Oh, my God.
I just
no,
he had, you know, elevator lifts in his heels. I failed.
People read that your column, oh, like, Jan has lunch. I don't think people understand the amount of research and work that go in, you know, because it's like the conceit is like it's like anybody who's good at something makes it look easy, you know, like you're just having lunch and having a conversation.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. And sometimes my editors got annoyed with me because I would be taking so long.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I talked to his ex-girlfriends. I wrote about his lack of child support. He was paying $150 for one of his kids a month for child support in, let's see, 1977. And, you know, he had all these kids out of wedlock and he wasn't supporting them. And he would make the women go after him.
He was almost a billionaire at the height of his wealth. Almost.
Yeah, he was
70th
he was
most wealthy person in Canada.
Yeah, he was really rich. He would hire elephants for his parties and paint them white. I don't know why he wanted white elephants. That was a stupid idea, but, you know.
That's his thing. That's his brand.
Yeah. So he's finally been caught. He's really old. He looks like hell. And they convicted him. And it's just wonderful. I was really happy when I heard that. But it's been a long time coming, waiting for this.
I am just flabbergasted. That's an incredible story. It's wild how we ignore our own stories.
Yes,
it's wild.
Exactly.
That this is. I mean, and I'm guilty of this too. I caught in the wake of this Nygaard thing, this headline about another predator, this guy I had never heard of before, Robert Miller. And there's this headline that just came out that he allegedly raped a 12-year-old in 1977. And I noticed mm-hmm. that, you know, this is from Brigitte Noël, who's an incredible investigator with CBC in Quebec, and she'd worked with us on the first Thunder Bay a little bit. And then I realized that there's a whole Fifth Estate, I think it was Enquête, it was the French language investigative show, and then the Fifth Estate pulled it, and this whole story of Robert Miller.
He's a reclusive Montreal billionaire. This private investigator was hired to tail.
Every night, there were females going in and out of the place.
Who is a billionaire? I had missed this completely.
Me
I don't
too.
Know how...
I had never heard of Robert Miller until your producer sent it to me and said, we're going to be talking about him along with Nygaard. And I go, well, I know who Nygaard is. Who's Robert Miller? And then I read it and I went, how can we not have known? He's Epstein too.
Epstein too. He's very low key. He's not like a big, larger than life personality. He's this like secretive rich guy who had this Future Electronics, one of the biggest companies in Canada, a multi-billion dollar company, not the Future Shop, just like they sell parts behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And the CBC, this is a very brave investigation because there are no criminal charges against him, which gives journalists a lot of cover. So Brigitte Noël and her colleagues, they uncovered a very similar network. This guy had this thing going very much like Epstein. He had a series of houses and he had a permanent suite at a hotel in Montreal and this whole system where girls were allegedly, they'd get paid to bring in their friends.
Yeah, just like Epstein did.
Just like Epstein. And he had his like bodyguards and enforcers. There was an investigator. The investigator was, he alleges that this guy Miller, his goons offered him a bribe of $300,000 to drop the investigation.
Which was initiated by Miller's ex-wife, who was trying to figure out what her husband was doing.
You know, it's interesting because usually the criminal charges are followed by the class action. But right now there are more than 40 women involved in a class action against this guy.
People are coming out of the woodwork because you're right. Nobody ever heard of him. And the girls, they were not women. I use girls technically. The girls did not know who he was. They just knew his name was Bob.
So creepy. You would be recruited by another 15-year-old.
Yeah.
Oh, come over to Bob's nice house. He's got a room full of gifts for you, jewelry and lingerie. And you could fill up a bag of gifts, and then he gives you an envelope of cash at the end. And Bob, two girls at a time, was his, like, it's gross.
And some people would say, well, they agreed and they got paid. But the criminal code says a minor who is paid... That is not consent. A minor cannot consent to having sex because they're a minor. It doesn't matter if they didn't fight, they didn't cry, and they took money. The criminal code says that is sexual assault.
Yeah, there's, and his lawyers tried to say, because at a certain point it was like, you know, the age of consent was 14 or something, and at a time when the Fifth Estate piece came out and the Enquête piece, they knew about victims as young as 15. Well, now there's an allegation of a 12-year-old in 1977. Wow. So this was a monster, a predator, allegedly, I have to say that word, in our midst since the year I was born.
Fifth Estate came out with it, and I didn't notice either.
Yeah.
I feel so bad. I didn't notice.
I mean, it seemed to be on YouTube, it's got like 1.5 million views. So I'm sure a lot of people listening are like, Jesse, you should have known about this guy.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, I did not know.
Yeah.
I don't feel like it's just me. I feel like this whole idea that like Me Too changed everything. Like, here's another story. A woman, she's an alleged victim of sexual assault, and the case against her alleged perpetrator was just thrown out due to delays at the courthouse.
Oh,
so is this the post Me Too era? Like, are we just having a media field day with these? Like, I don't know.
No, I think there has been a real change. The cases getting thrown out for delay has been happening forever. It's really awful. Our court system is backed up, but defendants have the right to a speedy trial. And if they don't get it, then their rights have been violated, and then it gets thrown out. And nobody worries about the victim who has taken the trouble and the trauma to go to the police. I mean, I've been involved in helping somebody who was sexually assaulted. And, you know, I said, you have a choice to not say anything or to go to the police. And I walked with her all the way through it. And in the end, the case was thrown out because of delays. Because, you know, some Crown attorney had to go on maternity leave and then something was lost and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, it happens all the time.
We have the rights of the accused. They also must be respected in our judicial system.
Everybody has a right to a speedy trial, and blame the system if these trials. But, you know, there's a legal tactic of trying to get things delayed as much as possible.
Yes.
You know?
So I think that we are changing with the Me Too movement. I think this Fifth Estate report did not land because I think that Quebec is so isolated culturally from the rest of Canada, mm-hmm. that we just don't pay attention. We sort of ignore them. They do their own thing. We ignore them. And I think that they didn't mention this in the Fifth Estate report that I watched, but his victims were all Francophones. He's an Anglophone.
Yeah.
And nobody talked about that. He's the predator of Francophone girls. Does that mean anything in the Montreal context?
It depends.
I think partly it won't affect his social circles.
I think there's that. I think there's a certain sense of using for cover. I mean, there may be class dynamics involved. I'm not sure much about the type of girls he was targeting.
A lot were runaways. A lot came from broken homes. They were vulnerable. Predators go after vulnerable. They don't go after people from happy families. The Fifth Estate had a really good interview with the former head of security at the Hotel Intercontinental,
who said, "You know, great."
She said she was outraged. At one point, she said, "How come all these girls are going to your room?" And he said, "They're my nieces." And she didn't do more because it wasn't the Me Too era. So she went, "Well, I don't have a complaint. What am I supposed to do?"
But she's with you, Jan. She's a person who saw it and tried. She tried.
Yeah, she tried. She talked to the police, and they dropped the investigation. I don't know why there are no charges. I don't know why they dropped the investigation before. And the Fifth Estate showed that they went after the girls and scared the hell out of them and said, you know, "We're going to charge you." And so I guess in that era and even today, the police really bungled. I mean, this whole idea that the women are not victims, but they're the criminals, right? They always blame the women.
The devastation that this stuff does to people's lives, that are, you know, when it happens so young, it severs people's relationship with their own parents. They can't talk about it. Like, it's really horrific.
It's horrific. That's why it's a crime.
And I just want to say, like, people are walking around with this idea that it's gone too far, and now every guy who's ever done anything even a little bit bad has been exposed. And the opposite is true. If you actually are exposed, it's like the stars have to line up. Like, it's not enough to be a predator. It's not even enough to be a billionaire predator. Like, it's like if you're a celebrity billionaire predator, you still have to live in the States for it to really stick, you know? Like, you know, like it's our interest in this is very conditional.
You have to have people stepping forward and saying, "He did it to me," and they all have to be the same stories, and they can never have talked to each other. I mean, the bar for getting convictions on this is unbelievable. That's why Nygaard, it was so gratifying. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, it was just thank you. Thank you.
Okay, Jan, let's duly note some things people should know about. What do you have to duly note today?
I would like to duly note my irritation with land acknowledgements. At the beginning of every event that I go to, they always say, you know, "We're on the land of the blah, blah, blah." And I am irritated because it's just empty talk. I would like to see people say, "I'll give up my reserved parking space for the Indigenous student on campus." Or I would like to see City Council say, "Okay, Indigenous people get free parking on Yonge Street and they can go in the TTC." But then I know this is going to lead to a problem of pretendians, right?
Sure.
So I'd like to talk about Buffy St. Marie. Now, the Fifth Estate did a story on Buffy, and I think it's the first time in my life that I've refused to watch it. Really irritates my friends, because I'm very happy to argue with them, but I won't watch it. And they say, "Well, you have no right to speak." And I wonder why, and it's just because I feel so bad about it. I feel so bad about what people are saying about Buffy. So there's land acknowledgement and Buffy all rolled into one. I just feel really bad.
The number of things that we might hear back from people about is really compressed there into one little quick minute of tape there, Jan. Thank you. Yeah, I don't know what to say about that, except that there's a piece in The Walrus that looks at the Buffy thing, and we're really having conversations here about, you know, how to go about these investigations and what, you know.
Yeah.
Because there's some serious, like solid journalism in the, like, I was ready to kind of hate it, and then I watched it, and it was pretty convincing and compelling.
I know, but what people tell me, but I feel so bad I don't want to watch it.
Yeah, and then there are some other questions that people have brought up about how they went about it that I think that, because we're doing work like that here, and it's good for us to, you know, it's good for us to duly note the discourse around the right way to do these investigations, mm-hmm. So duly noted. I want to quickly duly note the ongoing train wreck of Bill C-11, which we were told forever that this online streaming act would not affect user-generated content and podcasters. And then the regulations came out that said, "Oh, yeah, we are going after podcasters." And now they've got this new thing saying, "Oh, no, podcasters will not be regulated under this new streaming law." But then it's just like They're saying social media users like podcasters won't be regulated. So I don't know what the hell that means. And they had previously said that, like, my worry was not that podcasts would be regulated, but that the platforms that we absolutely require for, like, 80% of our listens, Spotify and Apple, mm-hmm. would be regulated. And then they, you know, could potentially just, you know, close up shop. So, you know, I think that this is a victory for the people who were from, you know, kind of YouTube creators. And there's a whole industry that's burgeoning of Canadian media creators who are like, get this the hell away from our stuff. We're doing just fine. And this is just messing things up. I think that they kind of, it looks like maybe they won. Like they got the clearest, they got the clearest message from government after the government refused to take an amendment from the Senate that would have just, you know, done this, you know, a long time ago. Uh-huh. But this seems like the clearest instruction that they're really trying to keep this away from online creators. It doesn't necessarily answer all the questions about the gray area between being like making a YouTube video in your bedroom for no money and being like some massive international conglomerate on the other. Mm-hmm. What about all the people who live in between those things? Still very hazy, but it looks like the resistance to C11 has yielded some results. And I wanted to point it out.
Okay, well then, duly noted.
That's Shortcuts, Jan Wong. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, it was really a lot of fun. Thanks, Jesse.
We are on Twitter at Canada Land. I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com about anything that you've heard today. Jan Wong, where can people find you?
Well, believe it or not, I'm still on Twitter, also known as X, and it's my handle is at Writer Wong.
Get it? Right or wrong? You're locked into it now for eternity.
It's embarrassing. I'm still on Twitter. I'm the last person. I'm going to be turning out the lights.
This episode is produced by Aviva Lassard with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofor. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Our theme music is by So-Called, syndications by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Thank you.